Hey there, Gwinnett Church. So this is the first time in quite a while we've actually been in the Gwinnett Theater recording. So we are taking steps toward getting back in business, if you will. But as you've heard me say, the church hasn't been closed. We have been, you have been doing an amazing things in our community. And so from blood drive, food drive, to serving and feeding the entire staff at North Forsyth Hospital. It's just the things that you continue to do and continue to lead students and children digitally and then gathering together as we've seen you do. It's just been phenomenal. So thank you for being an amazing church. And additionally, I've got some great news. I wanted to let you know, maybe you've already heard this, but we are targeting Sunday, August the 9th to be back opening in live gatherings at both Sugar Hill and Hamilton Mill. And obviously things can change from time to time, but that's kind of our plan. So you'll hear more information about that between now and then. Many of you have been asking, when are we going to get together? And I love that, right? But one of the things that you can help is we need more volunteers, and you're gonna be hearing more and more about us needing to recruit volunteers so that when we do open back up our physical gatherings, they're the experience that you're used to. And that's what we wanna do. And one of the reasons we've wanted to make sure that we're taking as much time as we can is to create the best possible experience for your friends, for your neighbors, your kids, and those that you wanna invite in, not just to Gwinnett Church, but into the story of God. Now, speaking of all that, you'll hear more about all of that later as we get closer to August the 9th. But today is Father's Day, if you're watching this on Sunday. And so I wanna wish all the dads a happy Father's Day. And speaking of that, you're gonna get to hear from an amazing father, a friend of mine, Pastor Lee Jenkins. Lee is the pastor of Eagles Nest Church in Alpharetta. He has a phenomenal background from NFL, the National Football League, to Wall Street, to a pastor. He's an incredible communicator. He's an incredible thinker. And 18 months ago, he did a message that he and I did together called Viewfinder, kind of tag teamed on this message. And in light of all that has happened in our world, I wanted us to revisit that message. And there are lots of reasons why. One of the reasons why is this isn't a new issue for us. Racial reconciliation, we believe, if you watched last week's message, is at the heart of the gospel, that God loves his children and he wants his children to love one another. Love God, love others, that's the ballgame. And so I wanted us to hear from Lee's perspective today. If you heard this message 18 months ago, I mean, that's 18 months ago. I think it's a great message to hear now. But if you haven't heard this message and you're new to Gwinnett Church, and so many of us are new to Gwinnett Church, and that's very exciting for us, I'm so excited that you get to hear from a friend of mine today who's gonna talk about this issue of racial reconciliation. So I would encourage you to text a friend, invite them into this message, and then thanks for being a part of this journey. It's been a crazy year, but in all of the challenges that we've had, we've been able to see God using this church, using what you're doing and leveraging what you're doing in fantastic ways, even amidst the challenges, the pain, and the heartache. And so thank you for being a church. Thanks for being for Gwinnett. And this message that Lee's gonna share with you today is indicative of who and what we wanna be known for. So thanks for being a part of Gwinnett Church.
So I am so excited to be here. I'm reminded of a story of a black pastor who had a ministry assignment on the West Coast. This black pastor lived on the East Coast and he was going to preach on the West Coast. He decided to bring his 8-year-old son with him on this ministry assignment. They boarded the plane, and the plane took off without incident. The plane went to 10,000 square feet, 10,000, altitude, that's right, 20,000, then 30,000. It finally reached 30,000 feet. Everything was going smooth. And then all of a sudden, the plane started to have some engine problems. And the pilot came over the public address system. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have a problem here. We're starting to lose altitude, but I don't want you to lose your life, but we're going to have to throw some luggage overboard because the plane is just too heavy. It would be better for us to throw the luggage overboard than for you to lose your life." So nobody liked the plan, but they said, "Okay, we'll do it." So, they threw the luggage overboard, and unfortunately, the plane kept losing altitude. It kept going down, and the pilot came back on the public address system. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have a plan. Some of you may not like it, but we have to do this." He said, "I'm going to have to ask some of you all to jump." He said, but listen, I wanna be fair, so I want you to do it in alphabetical order according to your race. In other words, if your race starts with an A, we need you to jump. If your race starts with a B, we need you to jump. Race starts with a C, etc. So everybody looked around. Nobody liked it, but they said, well, it would be better that a few of us should perish than all of us. So he said, okay, we need you to hurry. If your race starts with an A, we need you to jump. Everybody looked around and nobody moved. He said, if your race starts with a B, we need you to jump right now. Hurry up. The plane is going down. Everybody looked around and nobody moved. Then he said, if your race starts with a C, we need you to hurry up. And nobody moved. Finally, the 8-year-old boy, he punched his dad in the side. He said, Daddy, Daddy, we were supposed to jump. You're a man of integrity. Daddy, the man said A, and you know we're African-Americans. We were supposed to jump. Then he said, Daddy, then the man said B, and you know we're black, Daddy. We were supposed to jump. Then, Daddy, the man said C, and you know in some places they still call us colored. Daddy, we were supposed to jump. The daddy said, shut up, boy. Today, we're Negroes. So. It's a good time to say you're a Negro right there, isn't it? So today I want to speak to you not only from my perspective. My perspective is what God has done in my life. It is my perspective growing up in America as an African-American, as a black, as a Negro. But the bottom line, that I want to share my life with you, but I really want to share something that Jesus did. I want to share the life of Jesus and how Jesus dealt with this subject of racial reconciliation. Before we get started, I want you to know a little bit about me. My life started in the early 60s, and it started with my dad. My dad, Lee Allen Jenkins Sr., he was my hero. He was a football player at Fort Valley State University. Now, the reason he went to Fort Valley State, it was because he was one of the top running backs in the state of Georgia. If he was playing today in high school, he would be recruited by probably Southern Cal or Notre Dame or Tennessee or Georgia. Well, maybe not Georgia, but okay, yeah, all right. Georgia or Florida State. But at that time in the mid-50s, if you were a great running back and you were black, you couldn't go to Georgia. You couldn't go to Tennessee. You couldn't go to Auburn. You couldn't go to Florida State. And it was for one reason, not because he was not fast enough, not because he was not good enough, but it was for one reason, and that was because of the color of his skin. So my father was a star football player, but he wanted to stay in the South. And if you were a star football player and you wanted to play college football in the South, you had to go to a black college. Segregation was very prominent then. Even though my parents and my grandparents and my uncles and aunts, they paid state taxes, but yet they couldn't use state facilities. They couldn't go to parks. They couldn't live in certain neighborhoods. They couldn't go to restaurants. They couldn't drink out of certain water fountains. They couldn't ride public transportation. They couldn't even ride Greyhound or trailways. And then when they did ride the public transportation, they oftentimes had to go to the back and sit down. So those were the days of my father. And then at Fort Valley State, my dad, I met this beautiful woman, Alfreda Jenkins, and they met each other as freshmen, and they got married shortly thereafter. And it was pretty amazing what happened, because they had their first child, which was me. Yes. And so they had me, and they moved to Atlanta. And a lot of people say, wow, Lee, you're a native Atlantan. I say, yes, I am. And they assume that I was born in Grady Hospital. And I say, well, kinda, sorta. Because when I was born, Grady Hospital was not admitting black people. That didn't start until 1965. And I was born a few years before 1965. So if you were black and you were having a baby, or if you were black and you needed to stay in the hospital for a long time, you couldn't go to Grady. And so I was born in McLaren Hospital, and they had another hospital called Hugh Spalding. And so that's where the black people went in Atlanta. Well, I grew up in an all-black neighborhood, a very proud all-black neighborhood, not too far from downtown Atlanta for the first 12 years of my life. It was an incredible neighborhood. We had black doctors, black dentists, black entrepreneurs. I mean, the only time I saw a white person, if they were lost, that was it. I mean, it's just a part of my world was completely African-American. But some of my heroes were Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Andrew Young, Maynard Jackson, John Lewis, Hank Aaron. I would see these people on a daily basis. Maybe not a daily basis, but certainly every month or so, I would run into one or two of them. And so it was a great way to grow up. We had a lot of pride, and my parents never taught me to hate or to look at myself as a victim. They always told me that I could succeed and do anything that I wanted to do. Well, as good as my neighborhood was, there were some negative things. I used to get beat up by the neighborhood bully every few weeks. In fact, the bully used to take my lunch from me. And her name was, it was a girl, okay? And so I wanted to be like my dad. I wanted to play pro football and I wanted to play college football. The only problem is I wasn't good. The first football team I went out for, I ended up being the star tailback. Because every time I went out on the field, the coach said, Jenkins, get your tailback over here and sit down on this bench. So it didn't work out for me. Finally, I got to high school and I started to grow and get strong. And I started to get good in sports. And then I started growing an afro. Yes. There were two goals in my life in high school. I wanted to make good grades, you know, so I can go to college, and I wanted to be one of the Jackson Five. So I went through high school, and by the time I was in the 11th grade, some of these schools that I'd watched on television started coming to visit me. I mean, Alabama and Georgia and Florida State and Miami and Tennessee and Ohio State and Michigan, I couldn't believe it. I ended up choosing Tennessee. As Jeff said, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But I had a great time there at Tennessee because at 18 years old, as a freshman, in a Fellowship of Christian Athletes meeting, for the first time in my life, I heard the gospel clearly and I committed my life to Jesus Christ. Ended up becoming president of Fellowship of Christian Athletes with one of my best buddies, Reggie White, the late Reggie White, who played for the Green Bay Packers and the NFL Hall of Fame. And when we had an opportunity to lead hundreds of students to the Lord. I got drafted by the NFL with the New York Giants, didn't play long, got hurt in preseason. NFL for me stood for not for long because it was not long at all. Got out of the NFL, went into business for 25 years. I was trained on Wall Street, came back to Atlanta, started my career, spent 25 years in the investment business. My clients were very diverse. About 50% of them were African American and about 50% were white, and God really blessed me. 6 years ago, I really felt led to leave the business world and to commit my life to serving people as a shepherd, as a pastor. Started Eagle's Nest Church in Roswell, Georgia. And God has been doing some incredible things with us. In fact, we were featured in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution about a year or so ago. The largest article that they have ever done on racial reconciliation featured some of the work that I have been doing and our church has been doing in this area. We are in a predominantly white area, about 80%. We are a predominantly African-American congregation in terms of our composition, but we have been doing a lot of outreach to the community. We have been inviting Hispanics and whites and Asians, people to come into our environment. Let's worship together and let's get to know each other. In fact, that is the title of my message. Let's get to know each other. I love having this toy right here because I am old enough to remember this. And this is so apropos because our perspective, our history, our experiences determine a lot of our opinions, and sometimes it can even determine how we treat our fellow man. So race has impacted my life in a significant way. And so that's why I'm so honored to be here. I'm so honored that Jeff invited me to speak to you all, but I'm also glad that you are here because it shows that you care about this issue. And it also shows that you want to know God's heart on this most vital issue. So let's jump right into it. This morning, I want to share with you a fascinating story about racial reconciliation. It is the story of Jesus's encounter with the Samaritan woman. I'm going to pull out a few nuggets from this story because it's a long chapter. It's in the Gospel of John, chapter 4. So I can't go through every verse, but I just want to kind of pull a few key verses out that I think are very appropriate for what we're going to be talking about today. Let me give you some context and background first. In 722 BC, the Jews living in northern Israel were invaded by the Assyrians. And so some of the Jews were deported to Assyria, and some of the Assyrians were imported into northern Israel. And because these two groups got together, they ended up giving birth to a new ethnic group. In other words, the Jews hooked up with some of the Assyrians, and it birthed a new ethnic group called Samaritans. So a Samaritan is half Jew, half Assyrian. So the Samaritans were a mixed race of people. They didn't have pure Jewish blood, and because of that, they were despised by the Jews. The Jews didn't like the Samaritans, and the Samaritans didn't like the Jews. They didn't mingle with one another. They didn't live in the same neighborhoods. They didn't attend the same schools. They didn't eat together or drink from the same water fountains. They didn't vote the same way, and they didn't worship the same way. The Jews and the Samaritans couldn't stand each other. They had a very long, volatile history of segregation. So that's the backdrop. Doesn't that sound familiar? So what did Jesus do, and what must you and I do in order to promote racial unity? Because this subject is very important to God, so it should be important to us. The first thing we have to do is to be intentional about it. In other words, we have to do it on purpose. Racial unity doesn't just happen. It doesn't just get better with time. If you do nothing, it will actually get worse. And some of us just say, well, if I just let a little time go by, the next generation won't have to deal with this problem. Well, that's not necessarily the truth. Because as Jeff said, we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. And one of the reasons is we haven't been intentional enough about it. Let's look at John chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. And I'm going to show you how intentional Jesus was. Look at what it says in verse 3 and 4. It says, so he left Judea and returned to Galilee. And then it says he had to go through Samaria along the way. So Jesus was in Judea and he was headed to Galilee, but he had to go through Samaria along the way. Why did he have to go through Samaria? Let me show you why. Because he was in Judea and here was Galilee. Well, Samaria is where all the Samaritans live. And the Jews didn't want to deal with the Samaritans. So they didn't want to go through Samaria. If you were an Orthodox Jew, you would not go from Judea to Galilee in a straight line. What you would do to avoid being around these people, what they would do is go up here, and then they would take I-285 all the way around. And so they would go like 30 miles out of the way because nobody wanted to be with the Samaritans. But it says, but Jesus left Judea going to Galilee and he had to go through Samaria along the way. So he wasn't doing this merely because it was a shorter distance, because all of us have learned in geometry that the shortest distance between point one to point two or point A to point B is a straight line. So Jesus wasn't trying to save time. What he was doing is he was on a mission for racial reconciliation. And he was not afraid to confront the racial tension and division that had existed for over 700 years. So here's what Jesus wants us to know. We cannot change what we will not confront. And a lot of us want to see change in this area. We want to see America change. We want to see our neighborhood change. We want to see our churches change. But if you're not willing to do anything about it, if you're not going to be intentional about it, then you cannot change what you will not confront. We have a tendency to avoid things when it comes to dealing with race in this country. But how can we expect it to get better if we don't confront it? I remember being at the University of Tennessee, and there were a couple of decisions that the administration made that were very insulting, I guess you could say, to a lot of the African-American students. This was back in the early 80s. And so these students decided that they were going to do a march through campus to protest this decision. And so they asked me, being one of the popular football players, would I support them? I looked at the cause and I felt like it was a worthy cause. And so I decided that I was going to march with them. And so as we were marching around the campus, quietly, nonviolently, very respectfully, some of the people who were in the dorms were calling us names out of the windows, throwing stuff at us, calling us terrible stuff. And then we came down the street where my dorm was, and my dorm was an athletic dorm where all the scholarship athletes lived. And these were my teammates. And some of my white teammates were hollering and insults out of the window at us. And I couldn't believe it. These were the guys that I was in the huddle with. These were the guys that I was sweating with every day in the locker room. And I could hear them saying things. And I was so hurt. So I had to make a decision when I got back in the locker room that afternoon. Was I just going to not speak to them? Or was I going to confront it? And I remember going up to them and I said, "Hey guys, I saw you all hanging out the window and I heard what you were saying. And I was down there marching." They said, "What? Lee, we didn't know you were down there." I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, we didn't mean that for you, Lee. We just meant that for the rest of them." I said, no, I'm one of them. You can't say all this bad stuff and not insult me too." And these guys held their head down and they said, "Lee, we're so sorry." I said, "Lee," they said, "Lee, if we could respect you, we can respect them." And so to this day, when I see these guys, 20, 30, something years later, they still thank me for that because I was willing to confront the issue. So here's some questions that I have for you. How intentional have you been when it comes to building cross-racial relationships? How many people of a different race have you sought out to build a relationship with? Does everyone in your telephone contact list look like you? How about this one? Have you ever had a person of a different race over to your house for dinner? So Jesus was willing to do something that the other Jews were not willing to do, and that is he was willing to go straight through Samaria. Everybody else went around it. Everybody else wanted to avoid it. Jesus says, "No, I'm going to break tradition. I'm going to break protocol. I'm not going to allow culture to dictate how I love people and how I interact with people." And that is the same attitude we should have. The second thing Jesus did, and what we must do in order to promote racial unity, is we must engage each other socially. We must engage each other socially. One of the ways Jesus engaged the Samaritan woman was by starting with what they had in common. He didn't start with the differences first. He wanted to start by what they had in common. Let me show you this in verses 5 and 6 in John chapter 4. Look at this. It says, "Eventually he came to the Samaritan village of Sychar, near the field that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired from the long walk, sat wearily beside the well about noon time." They keep mentioning this well, and they keep mentioning Jacob. You see, Jacob's well was like Starbucks. It was where the people went to refresh themselves. everybody liked Starbucks, so everybody hung out at Jacob's well because the Samaritans loved and revered Jacob, but so did the Jews. So Jesus met this lady at a place that they both had in common. You see, when we are trying to build cross-racial relationships, you don't start with what you disagree on. You start with what you agree on. About a year ago, I ran for mayor of Roswell. As you all know, or maybe you don't know, Roswell is about 80% white, and I happen to be African-American, and when I put my name in the hat, people say there's no way. In fact, some of the experts said there's no way you can win or even get close. One political expert said that you won't even get out of the single digits. And I ended up getting 46% of the votes, almost won that thing. But what was interesting is all of these different groups would invite me to their homes or to talk to them for lunch because they wanted to know, what is this guy all about? Now, some people invited me to their homes or out to lunch, and they were excited about meeting me, but then some people were very suspicious of me for some reason. And it was probably because I was the first man of color to ever run for political office in that area. So I remember this one group of older white guys, they wanted to talk to me, and it was not going to be a friendly meeting. I'd heard they were saying some things about me that wasn't true, and so I figured the best way to deal with it is just to go confront it head on. And so I went to this restaurant, sat down with these guys, and the first thing that they said, well, they said, the first thing we want to know from you, Jenkins, is how do you feel about the NFL players kneeling? And then they say, and the second thing we want to know is how do you feel about them moving Confederate monuments from around the country? I said, well, guys, before we get to that, let's talk about our faith. What church do you go to? And tell me about your family. And let's talk a little football. I mean, we ended up talking about our faith. We ended up talking about our family. We ended up talking about football. And 2 hours passed. And after a while, we're laughing and we're hugging each other. And I mean, and we're having a great time. And then they say, you know what, Jenkins? We like you. We're going to support you. Here's a check for your campaign. I said, thank you very much. We never even talked about the whole NFL deal or the Confederate deal. You know why? Because it didn't matter anymore. What was important to them at first, as they got to know me over an hour and a half period, became minuscule. They were like, this doesn't even matter. We like this guy. We like his heart. And you know what? I like them too. You see, if we had started that conversation off talking about that, we might have had a different result. So when you're trying to build relationships cross-racially, don't start with what you don't have in common. Start with what you do have in common. And the number one thing you have in common is your faith in Jesus Christ. And you have a lot more things in common as well. I love what John 4, verses 7 through 9 says. So now Jesus is at the Starbucks, okay? He's at the well, and I want you to see what happens. Look at this. It says, soon a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, please give me a drink. He was alone at the time because his disciples had gone into the village to buy some food. The woman was surprised. Why was she surprised? For Jews refused to have anything to do with Samaritans. They have nothing to do with Samaritans. So she was surprised. Why is this guy even talking to me? In fact, why is he even engaging with me? Look what the rest of the verse says. She says to Jesus, you are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman. Why are you asking me for a drink? Don't you know what's been going on over the last 700 years? Don't you know that your people and my people don't interact with each other? Don't you know we're not supposed to even be talking to each other? Don't you know we don't do life, we don't share life with each other? Why are you talking to me? She was surprised. I believe Jesus knew what I'm about to tell you on this statement, and it is this. One of the greatest hindrances to racial unity is the unwillingness to engage each other socially. So one of the reasons we don't have unity is because we're unwilling to engage each other socially. Let's look at what Jesus did. I think we can learn from him and what he did. First of all, we have to see that Jesus, how he engaged this woman, he stepped out of his racial comfort zone. So Jesus entered this lady's world. How many times have you entered a world that you weren't accustomed to? So Jesus went to Samaria, but not only that, he entered this lady's world. Now this is, in general, this is typically easier for minorities than the majority culture. It's typically easier for blacks than whites. Why do I say that? Because whites are the majority culture. Being a minority, if you want to be successful, you have to learn how to assimilate. You have to learn how to do it on your job or maybe at a school. It's just a part of life. If you want to be successful, you have to learn how to assimilate with different racial groups. And by the way, that's a good thing. We grow from that. I've grown from that. From growing up in Atlanta, an all-black area, to going to the University of Tennessee, an all-white area. I mean, I grew from that. But when you are the majority culture, if you don't want to get out of your comfort zone, you don't have to. You can stay at an all-white church, an all-white neighborhood. Your kids can stay at an all-white school. And you can stay within your comfort zone if you want to. Why? Simply because you're the majority culture. So Jesus is trying to teach us something here. He's saying if you want to establish a relationship, then you're going to have to step across your racial comfort zone. You're going to have to do something that's a little different. I did that at the University of Tennessee my freshman year. All of the athletes, we ate in a particular cafeteria, and all the black guys ate on the right side and all the white guys ate on the left side. Even though we were brothers on the football field and in the film room and in the weight room, but when it came to the cafeteria, well, that's where we socialize. That's where we talk about our lives and our families and our girlfriends. And it was so segregated. And this was the early 80s. And so one day I'm talking to one of my teammates who was a white teammate, and I enjoyed the conversation, and I just decided that instead of going right to sit with the black guys, I was going to veer left. And I went and sat with the white guys. And some of the white guys looked at me and said, "What are you doing over here?" And then some of the black guys looked at me and said, "What are you doing over there?" And they have this name. It's called Uncle Tom. That's what they call sometimes a black person who reaches out to white people. And so I was castigated. But an amazing thing happened. I decided, since I was going to get criticized, that I was going to keep doing it every time I went in the cafeteria. And you know what? Then other guys started doing it. Next thing you know, you come in the cafeteria a few months later, and we were diverse. But it took somebody to step across the racial comfort zone. Here's another thing Jesus did. Jesus was willing to have intimate fellowship with her. That's huge. Jesus, a Jew, put his Jewish lips on a Samaritan cup. So this wasn't just a conversation. He was willing to have intimate fellowship. Now, what do I mean when I say intimate fellowship? You see, a lot of us have general fellowship. We go to a ball game together, and we high-five each other when the Falcons score a touchdown, and we hug each other, and it looks so good on the outside. Or we may even come to church together and we raise our hands and we worship together. And I'm not saying any of that is bad. It is awesome. But then after the service or after the football game, we typically go our separate ways. And we really don't share our lives with one another. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said the most segregated hour of the week is Sunday at 11 a.m. And I agree with that. But I would also say one of the most segregated hours of the week is Saturday at 6 p.m. Because Saturday at 6 p.m. is when you're with your friends, when you're with your family, when you're around the people that you love and you really care about. And that's also a segregated time. So Jesus says that we need intimate fellowship. We have to be involved in people's lives. We have to talk about things, not just window dress these relationships, But we have to really build relationships with each other. What's another thing that Jesus did? Jesus showed that he valued the woman. I'm sure his gesture to a Samaritan woman who was despised by Jews, I'm sure it just elevated her self-esteem. Wow, he cares about me. He values me as a human being. And that's what we ought to do with people. Value them as human beings. Lastly, Jesus remained a Jew. So during this interaction he had, he remained a Jew. Why do I say he remained a Jew? Because she says, how are you being a Jew? Ask me, a Samaritan, for a cup of water. Well, how did she know he was a Jew? Well, evidently he might have had a Jewish dialect. He might have looked like a Jew at that time. He might have had a beard or the way he was dressed. There was something about him that was very Jewish, so she knew he was Jewish. What am I saying? When you come into a relationship, you don't discard who you are. You bring that to the relationship because God loves variety. And so you bring your history, you bring your pain, you bring your perspective, and you bring that to the relationship. So as when I was at Tennessee, I mean, I was getting to know all these white brothers. They were getting turned on to R&B, and they were listening to music they never heard, and I was listening to country music. My family said, what has gotten into you? But the bottom line, we just rubbed off on each other. They didn't stop being who they were, and I didn't stop being who I was. By the way, that's what diversity is. That's what unity is. Unity is not sameness. Unity is when differences come together for a common purpose. Unity is when a football team comes together and you have people with different sizes, different speeds, different background, different colors, but boy, when they get on that team, they wear that jersey and they have one goal, that is to win. Unity is when you have a band or a symphony, you have different instruments, they even play different notes, but when you put it all together, it sounds so good. Unity is when you have a husband and wife who come together. Maybe they're completely opposite, like my wife and I are. We've been married 30 years, by the way. 30 years, and it has been awesome. But she is so different than me. For instance, she rolls the toilet paper under. I roll the toilet paper over. I roll it the right way. She rolls it the wrong way. How many of y'all roll the toilet paper over? Raise your hand, okay? All right, those are the saved people who love Jesus. Yeah, my kind of people. All right, how many of y'all roll it under? Okay, come on, don't be afraid. Okay, so, see, now you don't want to raise your hand, okay? They're like, okay. All right, so my wife, incredible woman, but she's a Kroger girl. I'm a Publix guy. You know, I'm a little OCD, it's just something about, like, Publix. It's just everything is so neat. The floors are white. It's like, wow, I love it. My wife said, yeah, but it costs a little bit more. I said, I don't care. It just does something to me. And that's what unity is. Unity is two differences coming together to make music. And that's what Christ wants us to do. Lastly, what did Jesus do and what must we do to promote racial unity? We must place Christ above culture. Place Christ, Jesus Christ, above our culture, above our race. He comes first. So, before I get into the next few verses, because this story is so detailed and there's so many twists and turns, as Jesus was confronting this woman, they got to talking about living water. And Jesus was talking about himself, and she thinks that Jesus is talking about, like, real water. So she was like, wow, I would love to have this living water where I don't thirst again. But then Jesus says, no, I'm the living water. And then Jesus says, go get your husband. And she says, I don't have a husband. He says, yeah, I know. He says, you've been married 5 times, and the guy you're shacking up with today is not your husband. Oh, by the way, we call it shacking up, all right? So I know sophisticated folks call it cohabitating. Okay. But the neighborhood I grew up in, we call it shacking up. So in other words, he calls this lady out. He calls her out. So look how she responds in verses 19 and 20. She says, sir, the woman said, you must be a prophet. So tell me, why is it that you Jews insist that Jerusalem is the only place of worship, while we Samaritans claim it is here at Mount Gerizim, where our ancestors worship? Now, she's getting theological on him. First, they were socially talking. Now they're talking about God. And now she's throwing out some truths about God. And so look how Jesus responds, because now this talk is getting really serious now. And look what he says. He says in verses 22 and 23, you Samaritans know very little about the one you worship, while we Jews know all about him, for salvation comes through the Jews. And then he goes on to say, but the time is coming, indeed, it's here now, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The Father is looking for those who will worship him that way. Oh, that's so pregnant with incredible theology and revelation, but let me break it down to you in a very simple way. Jesus was telling this lady, now you've crossed the line. You're wrong. Your daddy was wrong. Your granddaddy was wrong. Your great-great-granddaddy was wrong. Because she was trying to say, well, we worship this way, you all worship that way. We do it this way, you all do it that way. Jesus says, okay, the way you all are doing it is wrong. It's not pleasing to the Father. And so one of the reasons a lot of Americans have had difficulty experiencing true racial unity is because some of us care more about what our daddies or granddaddies or grandmamas or great-granddaddies did more than what Christ did for us. Now, we should honor our ancestors and our past and tradition, but we never put it above Christ. In fact, there cannot be a stronger commitment to tradition than to God's truth. So do you have a stronger commitment to tradition or to God's truth? I have stories galore. I was doing business with a guy, and he wanted me to introduce him to a lot of my contacts in the black community in Atlanta. And this guy had an incredible product, and he was going to wine and dine me, so he invited me to his house to talk to me about kind of partnering with him. And my wife and I went over his house in Buckhead, and we got out of the car, and we walked down the sidewalk leading to his front door, and right there on the porch are two statues of two black people. I think one was eating a watermelon, and the other one was like a jockey. I mean, and I was so offended, but I just had to compose myself. I went in, and I enjoyed the dinner with our wives. And then the next day, I called him up. I said, hey, man, I just want you to know how much I appreciate the dinner, and everything was great, but there was one thing that really bothered me. Those statues that you had were really offensive to me. Those statues depicted us as servants, and it was very demeaning. And I just want you to know, there's no way that I'm going to be able to introduce you to all these people and even to continue to do business with you if that's how you feel about black people. Because if you feel that way about them, then you feel that way about me. And he was just silent. He said, man, can I call you back tomorrow? I said, yeah, okay. So he calls me back. He says, Lee, I want you to know what you said to me really shook me. He says, those statues have been in my family for almost 100 years. He said, they've been passed down generation to generation He says, my family, they were plantation owners and they were very, very wealthy. And he says, so this is just one of the things that I inherited from my family. But I want you to know that last night I went and busted those things up. I broke them to pieces. He says, because I care more about you as my friend than I do about these statues and about this tradition. He says, I care more about you as a human being. And that's what Jesus wants us to know. Are you putting race above righteousness? Are you putting your politics above someone else's personhood? Are you more democratic than disciple? Are you more Republican than righteous? Well, as Jesus was having this conversation, it was kind of coming to a close, and the lady said, well, when the Messiah comes, he's going to straighten all of this out. You know, in other words, she didn't want to deal with it. She was deflecting the issue. And Jesus said, I am the Messiah. She says, whoa. So she went back to her village and she told some people, she's like, I met this guy and I think he's the Messiah. And y'all gotta come out and hear me. And look what happens, this last verse. And verse 39 through 42. Look at what it says. It says, many Samaritans from the village believed in Jesus because the woman had said, he told me everything I ever did. When they came out to see him, they begged him to stay in their village. So now the Samaritans and the Jews didn't even deal with each other. Now they're asking Jesus to stay over for a sleepover. So look what happened. It says, so he stayed for 2 days, long enough for many more to hear his message and believe. And then it says, then they said to the woman, now we believe, not just because of what you told us, but because we have heard him ourselves. It goes on to say, now we know that he is indeed the Savior of the world. So racial reconciliation is really not the goal. Really, the goal is to have a relationship, a profound relationship with Jesus Christ, so that people will know that Jesus is the Savior of the world. And they won't know that if you and I are divided. We need to show the world how to do this thing. You see, the reasons these Samaritans came to know the Lord is because of this act of what Jesus did. And so we have to show the world how this is supposed to be done. And when we do that, then we're going to see a lot more people believe. Maybe one of the reasons we have such a divided America is because we don't have a unified church. So I want to challenge you to do what Jesus did. Let's get to know each other. Let's do something even this week to step across our racial comfort zones. Let me pray with you. Father in heaven, we thank you for your word, which is so relevant, so potent for today. And Father, right now, we ask you to forgive us if we have not cared about this issue enough. So Father, help us to be answers to the problem and not a part of the problem. Lord, I pray for these men and women under the sound of my voice. I pray that you will use them for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen. Wow. God bless you.
Gwinnett Church, can we give it up for Lee? That was amazing. Okay. Lee, I just want you to know you should have run for mayor here, man. That's what you should have done. So, hey, everybody, thanks so much for being here. We hope you have a great week. Don't miss next week as we close out this series. God loves you, and so do we. We'll see you next Sunday.